funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What transpired at a Roman triumph, and how closely do ancient accounts match with what really happened? There are numerous stories on record of victorious Roman generals returning home to parade defeated enemies and accept vast rewards of treasure and power. But if you look closely at those written accounts and commemorative artifacts, you find a lot of them contradict each other, and some seem just plain impossible. So what does it take to get to the truth, and what do our mistaken assumptions reveal about the challenges of studying antiquities? Mary Beard is chair of classics at Cambridge and a fellow of Newnham College. She'll appear tonight at 7 at the Dallas Museum of Art to give a lecture entitled The Other Side of Conquest, Prisoners and Victims in the Roman Triumph. The book we'll be talking about today is called The Roman Triumph. Mary, welcome to Think.
Hi.
Can you start by giving us an overview of the conventional understanding of the Roman triumph, how it played out and who was eligible?
Conventional understanding is quite simple. If you won, you're a general, you've won a massive victory for the Romans against the barbarians. Some people said you had to have killed more than 5,000 people to qualify.
Like there's a checklist.
Yeah, checklist. You've got to count the corpses, right? So you count the corpses, you bring your army back home, you ask to celebrate what was called a triumph, which was a procession through the streets of Rome with a offering made to Jupiter, best and greatest, on the Capitoline Hill in the end. The Senate looked at your credentials and would say yes or no. Normally, I think yes. When the actual procession happened, it was supposed to be in the most amazing ceremony that Rome had ever seen. Ever, you know, repeatedly the most amazing ceremony. You got the general dressed up in the very costume of Jupiter, Optimus Maximus, Jupiter, the best and greatest, purple cloak, silver stars. He's in his chariot. Sometimes it's a gold chariot. Sometimes it's richly decorated with jewels. He's there. Behind him in the chariot is a slave who holds over his head a golden crown. And apparently it said, whispering in his ear the whole time, remember you're only a man, remember you're only a man.
Keep him humble.
Because, you know, he sure must have felt that he was a god in those kind of context, dressed up like a god. So he's there in the middle. Behind him are his probably rather drunken troops. And they were supposed to sing naughty songs about the general. That's also to keep him down to size a bit. You know. So the best one is the one about Caesar, where the troops apparently sang in some way, Romans, lock up your wives. We're bringing the bald adulterer back home. So they're making a frightful row behind. But in front, that's the amazing bit. What goes in front of the general is prisoners that he's brought, possibly captured kings, dressed in their exotic foreign costume, all waiting to go up to the Capitoline too, sometimes to be killed before they got there. Then you get booty and loot beyond belief, so it said. Yeah, piles and piles and piles of captured coin and bullion. You get furniture that they've got from the conquered provinces. You get plants and animals. Sometimes you get elephants. Sometimes you get ebony trees. And it's all going up to celebrate the greatness of Rome and the greatness of the general. And also, the things that art historians now get very interested in is that when they're conquering Greece, there were masses of statues came. So a great masterpiece works of art also flowing in front. So it was like a kind of, one Roman historian compares it to a river. Says like a river going through the streets of Rome, as if somehow kind of this was all naturally just pouring into the city. So simple view is greatest celebration of Rome's vile militarism and imperialist expansion that there ever could possibly be.
You know, I hear about that spectacle and I think it certainly sounds like the world's greatest military recruitment tool and an incentive for the good citizens of Rome to continue dumping tax dollars into these kinds of things.
That's what the Romans thought, or that's what some Romans thought. And one rather canny observer said, you know, thinking that what's taxpayers' money going into, it enables the people of the city to see what the general had been getting up to in the provinces and on the frontiers. Because also, they're quite good at sort of having sort of press releases amongst all this, these visual press releases. So you'd get paintings of famous moments in the campaign when, you know, particularly if the enemy king had sadly been one of the 5,000 massacred, you'd have a picture of his, you know, his death scene, or you'd have a model of the towns they taught. So the kind of wonderful mixture of the actual loot and also telling the guys in the street who were effectively paying for this what had been going on overseas.
So we'll get in just a minute, Mary, to the myriad reasons why you think that a lot of this may be inaccurate. But I first want you to talk about why you think so many scholars have been so eager to sort of swallow this conventional wisdom view.
I think we've got so much invested in thinking of the Romans as, you know, over the top, brute imperialists with no sense of limit. and we do that all the way through, don't we? Everything we think about Rome is larger than life. You know, they are more obscene than anybody else. They have bigger orgies, bigger dinner parties. The Colosseum's always full watching gladiators being, you know, fighting to the death. Everything that we want to think about Rome is kind of bigger and more vulgar and more cruel than anybody else. And somehow I think that really plays over into the Roman triumph, that it suits our vision of the Romans to think of them as being completely unthinking in their glorification of warfare. And it also kind of suits our own image of other bits of history too, because the great thing about the triumph, and it's something which really hasn't yet gone away, is it's not only a Roman ceremony, although that's what I'm interested in mostly, but it's been copied and imitated by all kinds of other cultures. You know, from the moment that the Roman Empire's declined, there are people there ready to do their own triumph. So, 1899, there was a triumph in New York for Admiral Dewey after he'd come home from the Spanish-American War, and he went through the streets and underneath a kind of paper cardboard triumphal arch, being a Roman general. So it's not just that we want the Romans to be brute militarists anyway, but it's formed quite a useful way for us to celebrate our own military victories as if somehow we didn't have anything to worry about and we could be really proud of them.
You know, I also hear these stories and I realize that the Romans themselves must have had as much invested in making these accounts a little bit larger than life, making the pictures even more glorious than the actual event.
Yes, that's obviously true. I think that every general wanted to have a triumph better than every other general. So, you know, because that's part of that's the competitive zeal of the Romans. You know, you're going to do it better than the last guy, and so they're constantly writing up their own experiences or having their own triumphs written up, always to up it. This has got more coin than the last bloke, or more statues, or I've got, you know, more elephants than you had. And we did. And sometimes people now writing on Rome a bit gullible about believing all this, and they see these tremendously boastful descriptions and they think, gosh, that's impressive, without thinking it through, I think.
What sort of verification were the generals required to submit when they got back from one of these campaigns in order to apply for a triumph?
Well, that is a real problem. I mean, because one of the difficulties about living in Rome and trying to, you know, in any kind of political way and trying to have any idea of what was going on at the frontier was how news came back. And we simply don't know how they managed to verify it. We do know that sometimes, you know, even the Romans thought, you know, come on, you know, this doesn't sound quite right. You know, you say you killed 25,000.
But there were that many people around.
You know, surely some mistake here. And so there are occasions when we have little, you know, just get little hints about the Senate who would have the power to vote for the triumph or not, saying, let's just wait until the officers come back and we'll ask them to see if this all adds up. So you can see them being cautious. They're not stupid, but it's always very, very hard to know whether to believe the general.
And how hotly debated were the people allowed to get triumphs in the Senate. Can you talk a little bit about that process?
Well, it was clearly a way of doing in your enemies, right? If you got a personal enemy, one thing you'd try and do is not let them have this wonderful bit of glory. You know, what did every little Roman boy dream of having? You know, a triumph. You know, it's like being president of the United States or, you know, prime minister of Britain. A triumph is the acme of glory. And so, of course, when the general comes back, whatever he's done, there are guys there who are trying to do him in or to help his case or whatever. And it's a marvellous occasion when Cicero comes back in about 50 BC. And Cicero is maybe the world's greatest orator. Fantastic, genius intellectual. Not a fantastic soldier, however. And he had, however, secured a rather sort of feeble victory in a skirmish in Cilicia in modern Turkey. And it's one of the ways you can tell, I think, how tremendously important triumphs were to every Roman is the way that even Cicero, you know, who's not the world's greatest soldier, starts to think, little victory, I think I triumph now. And because we've got some of Cicero's original letters, amazingly, some of his original letters surviving, we can see a little bit of the lengths he went to try and get this triumph awarded for him. I mean, he wrote, for example, individually to every member of the Senate. Now, people look at this and they say, gosh, what an idiot Cicero was. You know, fancy doing that. But I suspect he's doing what people usually did. You know, you've got to canvass your support. He wrote individually, must have taken days, but it's terribly important to get your view across.
It's amazing how modern this all sounds.
Oh, it's wonderfully modern. You know, it's absolutely marvellous, and there are all sorts of resonances that we can have with, you know, with our own times. I mean, what one of the problems that came up was not so much victories being invented, although Cicero himself said that some of these victories had been invented, but frightfully premature. You know, that they claimed.
And, you know, they're not quite done yet.
You know, I just see mission accomplished when I read about this. I think, you know, just wait a bit. You know, you've won the first bit, wait. And the Romans were actually quite worried about premature victories. And, you know, it was all very well to have had a bit of success, but we want to see their job finished, actually. You know, and that's a different matter. And so there is, you know, there are marvellous echoes in our own time about premature victories in the Far East.
Would there have been kickbacks for this sort of thing? Would they have said to the senators who were on their team, look, if you do this, you get two elephants and a bag of jewels?
I bet. Now, you can't document it. But I think one would have to be a bit naive to think that that voting for, say, Cicero's triumph didn't come without its own reward. Although it is actually very, very hard to find out what happens to this stuff. You know, all this stuff goes through the streets, get loads of descriptions, gets up to the Capitoline Hill where it's going to be sacrificed to the god Jupiter. Dinner's going to follow because they also do a nice dinner after this, just as we would. What happens to the stuff? And no one ever tells us that.
Mary Beard is my guest. She is chair of classics at Cambridge and a fellow of Newnham College. Her book that we're talking about today is called The Roman Triumph, and she'll be lecturing at the Dallas Museum of Art tonight at 7. You can find information about that on the Think page of KERA.org. We'll be back to our discussion in a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@KERA.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Chair of Classics at Cambridge and a Fellow of Newnham College, Mary Beard. She's in town for an address at 7 tonight at the Dallas Museum of Art. The lecture is called The Other Side of Conquest, Prisoners and Victims in the Roman Triumph. The book that we're talking about today is called The Roman Triumph. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. Mary, what could go wrong in a Roman triumph?
Now, that's a really interesting thing, because when we think about a triumph, we tend to think about it all going right. Yeah? And we think, how wonderful, general's finest hour. But of course, if things went wrong, it was the general's greatest embarrassment. And my favourite story about things going wrong is a story of a hugely important general, Pompey the Great, who is having a triumph in 1st century BC. It's partly to celebrate some victories in Africa. And he decides that instead of having his chariot pulled by horses, as was usual, he would have it pulled by elephants. Right? Now, it's quite interesting. That was not only a very vulgar thing to do, but it also made him look even more like a god, because the god Bacchus had reputedly had a triumph once upon a time, and Bacchus's chariot was pulled by elephants. So it makes him look more divine. So everything's fine. How he got these elephants yoked to the chariot, who only knows? But off he goes. Comes through an arch halfway along the route, and he tries to get the elephants through the arch. And they get stuck. So, oh, help, what do you do now? So the story is, and I don't really believe this, he reversed the elephants. I don't know how you reverse the elephants, but the elephants reversed and they tried again. Right, can we get through the arch now? Squeeze up, boys, try again. And it still wouldn't fit. And so he had to get off the chariot, he had to unyoke the chariot, he had to take the elephants away or have them taken away and get some horses brought up. And that's a wonderful, wonderful example of humiliation. You know, general's finest hour, but he overplayed his hand. And that story, of course, is told as a warning to future generals, I think. You know, don't try it with elephants, guys, because you'll get stuck and you'll look a frightful fool. So there's this awful possibility always, like we know, you know, your finest hour turns into your greatest disaster. And that happened with more triumphs than Pompey. I mean, Caesar had his triumphal chariot axle break and he had to wait for a new chariot to come along.
Well, I even wonder about the security questions. I mean, granted, you have a lot of soldiers parading through the streets, but was there pilferage of all these gems being shown by?
It's extraordinary. We don't get any stories about that. There's lots and lots of stories about the periphery of the triumph, about what people can see and can't see and what they understand and what they say to each other. Nothing about robbery, whereas it seems so obvious to us that you've got, you know, load and load and loads of carts of coin. Doesn't someone try and help themselves? But that's never mentioned. So it's peculiar, and I think we've got to reckon that the Roman writers telling us about this have their own blind spots. You know, it's not that there wasn't pilfering, just they chose not to see it.
Now, the Romans would tell us back then that the first triumph actually belonged to Romulus, who was the founding father of Rome. What do we know about that? And
Well, it was a wonderful myth. I mean, you know, we had no clue whether Romulus existed, but the Romans thought he did. And I think what it's telling us is when they imagine the first triumph was held by their first king. And in some accounts, they even make it on the first day of the city. Now, this is clearly completely impossible. But I think what it's saying is it's reminding us that they're thinking of the triumph as an institution which really defines Rome. You know, that the triumph is as old as the city of Rome itself. And it lasts as long as Rome is Rome. And you know, they must have known too that this was completely impossible. And anyway, you know, well, what would the booty have been in the 8th century BC? A couple of cows, I suppose. But nonetheless, what they want to do all the time is to say there's never been a moment when Rome has not celebrated its victories in this way. Even if they were just over a kind of few neighbouring tribes down the road, the triumph is our ceremony. It's about how we celebrate victories and how we're always going to go on doing so.
Were they the first ones to do it?
Good question. Again, sometimes they seem to think that their northerly neighbours, the Etruscans, had had a kind of proto-triumph. The trouble about that is that the Romans often decided that the Etruscans had done things before them. I mean, when the Romans sat down and said, I wonder where our triumph comes from, or I wonder where our this comes from, you know, someone will always pipe up and say, I think we got it from the Etruscans. So I think we can't know where it comes from. And you know, we certainly can't know that it really goes back to the 8th century BC. And some people have certainly thought it was more likely an invention that gets going when Rome starts having rich conquests in the 4th or 3rd centuries.
So I want to talk about these paraded captives, because by some accounts there are thousands of people that have been taken. And one of the problems you point out is that it took a while to get a triumph underway. It could take months or even years to organize this whole thing.
As soon as you start out, and I think in a female way, I rather looked at the kind of housekeeping of this. You
know? Who's going to take charge of this detail?
Yeah. A lot of the stories that we are told just don't add up. And I think it's very clear that the prisoners, the stories about the prisoners can't really make sense. I mean, you've got prisoners captured on the battlefield. I mean, once you've killed your 5,000, you've got some that are left. You've got to get them all the way back to Rome. The victory might have been well into the hinterland of Asia Minor, modern Turkey. Then you've got to keep them. The triumph might not happen for months after you get back, depending when it can be arranged. You've got to keep them somewhere. You've got to feed them. Rome doesn't have anything like prisons. I mean, one of the amazing things about Roman culture is that, you know, unlike we have prisons by the thousand in the modern West, and the Romans didn't know about prisons. So how on earth do they keep these people? Now, you know, you can say, oh, well, we just haven't discovered that yet. I suspect, and there are some hints of it, that what you have in the way of prisoners is a kind of a carefully chosen selection. You know, you want some good prisoners and you want some exotic ones. And one account of a triumph in the 1st century AD says that the general chose the tallest ones to come back. But I think a rather careful selection of prisoners is made. And that, of course, makes their keeping a bit easier than if you've got masses of thousands and thousands.
And you want them exotic because that reinforces how, if you're not like a Roman, you're not going to do well?
I think you want to say, look, I've had a stunning victory. And you don't want to have a victory over a real kind of rabble of beggars. You know, the Roman victories are good in Roman terms because they have worthy, exotic and striking enemies. Right? You know, and you don't want to be a general who, you know, just defeats a load of slaves. You want to be a general who defeats a rather important, brave and in their own way, even though there are enemies, virtuous and kind of feisty enemy. And therefore, you've got to have a rather careful selection of who you've got on display to make sure that it reflects well on you. In fact, one of the things we know about Pompey, who had trouble with the elephants, he has a series of sort of triumphal anecdotes attached to him. And he once wanted, and this is a very topical moment, he was celebrating victory over pirates. Pompey was good at defeating pirates. But in fact, one of his fellow members of the Senate had a quite good victory over pirates a few years earlier and had captured some very, you know, good, you know, exotic, dramatic-looking specimens. And Pompey kind of snitches the prisoners to having his own triumph.
They're like extras.
Yes. So, you know, a bit like seat fillers at an awards ceremony. You need to have, you know, very nice-looking, good, tall and fierce.
So that leaves us with the problem of what would have happened to Cleopatra if she hadn't killed herself.
This poor old Cleopatra. I mean, it's a real problem, Cleopatra, because the story goes that she was defeated by Octavian, who was going to become the first Emperor Augustus. And the one thing Cleopatra didn't want to do was be in a triumphal procession, because she knew just how humiliating that was for a prisoner. You know, thousands and thousands of onlookers, no doubt, you know, pelting you with the Roman equivalent of rotten tomatoes, being a kind of almost a piece of booty, a sort of human piece of booty. And the story is that she killed herself with the asps or without the asps, we don't know, in order to avoid being in Octavian's trial. And that may be true. But a more cynical version would be that actually Octavian was a bit cannier than he might seem. And he knew, because he'd studied the history of the triumph just as much as I have, that that there was always a danger that prisoners, particularly pathetic female prisoners, when carried in procession, risked upstaging the general himself. That the crowd,
because we sympathise.
We sympathise. We look at them. There's this, you know, weeping woman, and there are all kinds of stories of the audience lining the streets of Rome, but instead of looking at the general and cheering, looking at the female prisoner and crying. Now, I think that Octavian was probably shrewd enough to see that Cleopatra was, you know, possibly a piece of booty that was too hot to handle. And at least he encouraged the suicide and then put out this story about, oh dear, how terrible, I wanted her for my triumph, but she killed herself. And he has, of course, a model of her made instead.
You know, those accounts of people crying as they watch the pathetic prisoners walking by doesn't really speak to the bloodthirsty Rome that we get from studying the rest of the triumph.
No. And I think that's where my slightly different take on the triumph comes in. Because I think, you know, clearly to some extent, you know, Romans aren't a load of pacifists. You know, or very unsuccessful pacifists if they were. Of course, they're brutal militarists. But I think that it's often brutal militarists who have a very good idea about the downside of militarism. You know, because victories, you know, always is the other side of defeat. And the Romans, I think, in their descriptions of the triumph, and we must imagine, I think, too, in their reactions to the triumph, saw that just as it paraded the success of Rome, it also paraded the dangers and the potential immorality of military conquest. Now, you partly see that in the stories we talked about things going wrong, but you also see it in the comments people make, which really show up how debated, even in a country as militaristic as Rome, the idea of imperialist aggression was. There's a wonderful philosopher called Seneca who once had the kind of really bad luck to be tutored the Emperor Nero, which must have been a pretty bad job. And he said, criminals, small-time criminals get punished. Big-time criminals get rewarded with a triumph. Which is a very kind of nice ancient equivalent of what we'd say in Britain, which is, you know, small scale criminals end up in prison, big time criminals end up in Parliament or end up in the House of Lords or something like that.
We could adapt that here, I think.
And I think what you're seeing there is this sense that people can watch this procession, however grand it is, and I'm pretty certain that it isn't as grand as they like to make it out. And they can think, well, is this moral? You know, is actually all this booty flowing into the city of Rome? Is that quite right? You know, how did we get it? And when we look at the prisoners, then actually the Romans are just going to cry about the sad children and the sad women. They weren't so kind of keen on crying about the wicked kings, but you know, the unarmed combatants who are also going through the city too, and they can reflect on the other side of that as much as we can. And I think that's where you do start to see a slightly different view of the Romans. You know, that, you know, okay, they're big brutal conquerors, but they're not big brutal conquerors who haven't seen that there's another side to all this.
Mary Beard is my guest. She's chair of classics at Cambridge and a fellow of Newnham College. Her book that we're discussing today is called The Roman Triumph. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Charlie in Lakewood. Hello, Charlie.
In reference to the potential of the hoi polloi looting Caesar's parade as it goes through of its jewels and other treasures, I have heard a number of times that in the days of the autocrats, Genghis Khan and Tamerlane, that caravan of camels bearing naked virgins and great treasures of silk and spices would be perfectly safe because of the universal intimidation that these guys had, that if you touched any of their treasures, that was the end of you.
Yeah, that's certainly one possibility. I mean, I think that these processions must have been, in a sense, so impressive that they might really have been their own kind of way of preventing looting. I mean, you know, the British go in for a lot of processions and all sorts of things go past in coronations and royal weddings and things. But you don't actually need the police there to keep people off because, in a sense, the whole panoply of glory and the people on horses and the uniforms and, in a sense, the sheer state power on display is almost, in its sense, itself enough to mean hands off everybody. So one explanation of the lack of stories of pilfering is that the Romans were actually intimidated, I think, by this kind of procession, as we might be.
How long did a triumph take?
A good day. I mean, basically it took a day. And if you needed more than a day, you had to do it over 2 days or 3 days. And what happens is that as their victories get richer and richer, they start to say, help, you know, this isn't going to fit into a day. So you end up with some 3-day triumphs in which you kind of have all the gold and silver on one day and statues on the next. And whether the audience actually sustains all this, and well, that's another question, because the way that the stories about it are told, there's always a cheering audience, you know, clapping and applauding our boys as they come home. Whether that was really the case always, who knows?
We are talking with Mary Beard, who will be giving a lecture at the Dallas Museum of Art tonight entitled The Other Side of Conquest, Prisoners and Victims in the Roman Triumph. We'll return to our discussion in a moment and have a couple of lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You also can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Mary Beard is here. She's chair of classics at Cambridge and a fellow of Newnham College. Her book that we're discussing today is called The Roman Triumph. She'll be giving a lecture this evening at 7 at the Dallas Museum of Art. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. So we did a show last week about Spartacus, and I was wondering whether Crassus would have had a triumph after putting down the slave rebellion.
Crassus wanted a triumph.
Like everybody, I guess.
Yeah, like everybody. But he was slightly palmed off with second best, actually, because there was a kind of lesser rank triumph called an ovation, in which most things were the same, except you didn't travel in a chariot. You had to walk.
Huh.
And it said that Crassus didn't qualify for a triumph, not a proper, a full chariot-style triumph, because he'd only defeated slaves, and that wasn't a really worthy opponent. It had to be a worthy opponent to get a proper triumph. So Crassus was none too pleased, I think, to discover that it was an ovation only for him.
We should say that traveling in that chariot was no easy thing because they were supposed to be carrying something in each hand, right?
Where I started to disbelieve some of the stories about the triumph was when I started to work out exactly what it would involve being in the chariot, because you've got an unsprung chariot, you've got a scepter to hold in one hand and a laurel branch to hold in the other. So how do you hold on? For a start, you've got a slave behind you holding this blasted crown and telling you you're a man.
Whispering, yeah.
And if you've got kids between about 7 and 14, they travel in the chariot too. It must have been absolutely a kind of either a balancing act, or it wasn't quite what it was written up to be. But there's a nice quote from one later emperor who has had a triumph, and he gets down finally after the end of this day, trundling around the Roman streets, these dreadful cobblestones, an unsprung chariot. And he's supposed to have said, "That'll teach me to want to triumph at my age."
Let's go to the phones and speak with Phil in Dallas. Hello, Phil.
Yes.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Yes, I have two questions. The first is, we have just a tremendous amount of detail about Roman history. Where are these earliest documents? I mean, were they carved into tablets? Where do we get all this information? And you had mentioned earlier that we have some original Cicero's letters. And second is, what did an average scroll, you see in the movies all the time, and Romans with the scrolls, was it like a poster rolled up or 12 inches tube? Or I mean, what was an average scroll and what was it made out of?
Yeah, that's a really good question. For the triumph, we have some absolutely contemporary bits of documentation, but those are all inscribed in stone. So that the Emperor Augustus, for example, in the first century BC, he had a list of all the previous triumphing generals inscribed in the Forum. But most of the rest of these original documents, that I'm calling original documents, come down to us by a rather more tortuous process. That's to say, they were copied throughout antiquity, throughout the ancient world. Romans made copies of them in the same way as we publish things, but this was all done by hand. And then they were still thought important enough to be copied by largely medieval monks sitting in their monasteries, thinking that despite the fact they were pagan, they were nevertheless still kind of rather good, improving literature. And so those letters of Cicero, we believe that they were copied and sort of published in that ancient way by his secretary after Cicero's death. But they always seemed important enough for people to keep copying right the way through until they were eventually published in a traditional printed form in the Renaissance in the 15th and 16th century. So the ancient book trade was a bit like ours, but it was all built on hand copying and, as you say, on these scrolls which you had to read. They weren't books like us. You had to kind of unroll and unravel these scrolls. And the length of those scrolls would vary, but they would be kind of longer than a poster, I think. You could get, I suppose, 800, 900 lines of poetry would fit in a scroll. And you had to start at one end and you had to gradually unravel to the other. And it must have been quite complicated. And it was also thought to be the height of rudeness, it said, to not then wind it back.
So the next... Be kind, please rewind.
The next reader, it's like leaving the video in the old kind of videotape, leaving it at the end of the video. You're supposed to wind it back to the beginning. So obviously it was quite cumbersome.
Do you have the same issues with all of this recopying that biblical scholars have to deal with? You know, a letter transposed here, a word left out there.
Yeah. There's all problems about that kind of accurate or not accurate copying. And that's where some of the problems about the triumph come in, because one of the things that always gets copied wrong is numbers. Always. And, you know, so there's the equivalent of kind of adding a few noughts on the end. So you know, when we're told that there are millions and millions of coins, you know, maybe that's Roman exaggeration, or maybe it's copying mistake, and it's very hard to know.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Mansfield and speak with David. Hi, David.
Hi, how's it going today? Thank
Great.
You for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, my question is, how did the Romans, as they're adding new territory to their empire, make the people submit that they've conquered? Because the reason why I ask is, when you compare it to the American army now in Iraq, it seems like we're a good conquering army, but we're not a good occupying army. It seems like in the back in the day, they'd have to use sheer brutality to break the will of the people. But how did they assimilate those folks?
Yeah, that's also a very good question. I think they do it in two ways. One is they come in with absolutely unbeatable force. I mean, nobody can beat a Roman legion if they're fighting on the flat. Guerrilla warfare can do it, but not on the flat. Then I think, though, they work in a rather tactical way. That if you look at the Roman Empire, there's actually rather few men on the ground. And they do, and they manage to control it in two ways, really. One is they make alliances with the local elite bigwigs in the province. So they get onto their side, the local aristocrats, and they use those men to control the province. The other thing is they have rather low aspirations about what kind of control they want. You know, they don't want to spread Roman religion. They don't want to spread Roman culture particularly. What they want to do is make sure the taxes get paid. And so an awful lot of life can go on as before in the Roman provinces, as long as they cough up the money and don't rebel. And in that, the local elites are absolutely crucial, and they're bought off with increasing rewards like Roman citizenship, and eventually with rewards such as becoming Roman generals and magistrates themselves. So they do it, as in a sense, in a way I think we try to do it, but rather less successfully. They do it by making alliances with elite collaborators.
So in not demanding cultural assimilation, I guess in that respect they were somewhat like Genghis Khan. You'll hear that he didn't really care they were doing day to day.
Yeah. And completely different from, say, the British Empire, which was in part validated by spreading Christianity. The Romans are not bothered about religious practice unless it's like the Druids and encourages rebellion.
They didn't need to justify what they were doing.
No.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Bill in Dallas. Hello, Bill.
Hi. I want to ask a couple of quick questions. One is, what is it about the Persians that's made them so scary to the West for so long? And the other is, as a person who looks at civilizations in our whole temporal scope, where do you think the United States is right now?
I knew we were going to have this sooner or later. Thanks for your call.
Those are tricky ones. The Persians is the easiest question. I think I'll come to the other one later. There's two factors, really. One is that Persians have got a long history of being the enemy of the West. By the time the Romans get there, they've already been brought up on stories and myths of the Persians' battle with the Greeks. In a sense, they take that over as their own struggle. Secondly, actually, not only the Persians, but all those empires out east really are formidable enemies of Rome. I mean, Rome is more or less commanding the whole of the known world, but its biggest, most serious threat is from those Eastern empires, the Persians and the Parthians. And in fact, to go back to old Crassus, once he'd put down Spartacus, eventually he goes out to fight some real non-slave enemies, in the shape of the Parthians, who are very near neighbours of the Persians, and he is terribly defeated in one of Rome's worst defeats. And the horrible story of Crassus's end is that he was decapitated and his head ended up being used as a kind of improvised prop in a performance of Euripides' play, The Bacchae, which features a decapitation in the court of the Parthian king. So, I mean, you know, there's serious military threat out there.
And do you want to touch the parallels between the Romans and the U.S. military?
I've got to touch the parallels, because I think that they are now debated, and there is something here which is, I think, illuminating on both sides. And you know, I already mentioned, the George W. Bush mission accomplished moment, and I think there's plenty in some of the more recent Western, not just American foreign policy, that fits very neatly with what you learn about in Rome. Whether America is the modern equivalent of Rome, whether the American Empire is our equivalent of the Roman Empire, and so, as some would say, destined to fall just like the Roman Empire did, I think is a trickier one. And I think one of the things that is really different there is what I was saying about cultural imperialism, that Roman culture did spread, undoubtedly, but the Romans were not driving any kind of imperialist message that was tied to Roman culture. You know, you didn't have to read Virgil to be part of the Roman Empire quite happily and pay your taxes. Now, if America is an empire, it is at least in part an empire of American culture. It's the Coca-Cola empire, and that is completely different. So I think in terms of global superpower, the Romans were the global superpower, the Americans are the global superpower, but they're superpowers in very different ways.
And I suppose even if a country like the United States didn't maintain sort of military power, cultural hegemony is much harder to change.
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, and it's embedded in television programs and things we eat and drink, hamburgers. You know, the American empire is seen in the hamburger, I think.
Why is it so important that we get this right, the story of the Roman triumph?
I think that it's always good to see that history is more complicated than we think it is. I think it's dead easy to sit back and think the past is simple, and then to use that past in its simplified form as a way of thinking about the present. And so triumph is for victory. Victory is straightforward. Victory is uncontested and wholly good. Booty is the profit of empire, and there is no downside. That's the traditional message of the Roman triumph. Now, I think it is salutary for modern cultures to realise that ancient cultures that they look back to were never quite as simple as they like to imagine. And if we start to look at the difficulties about how we know what we know, but also at all the ways in which the story we usually tell us ourselves isn't quite so straightforward, we get a better message about the present than we do if we just take the traditional stories on trust.
Is there a particular question that you would love to answer that you've never seen any sort of documentation that would allow you to even take a stab at it?
What the general did once he'd got up to the Capitoline. And the really funny thing about the triumph is that you've got all this lavish documentation about the procession, and you can see it pretty well weaving its way through the streets of Rome. It climbs up the Capitoline, it gets to the temple. Now, we do have some idea that there was a good old dinner after this, but nobody tells us what happens next. And I'd love to know what happened to the booty and what happened to the general.
Mary Beard has been my guest. She is chair of classics at Cambridge and a fellow of Newnham College. The book we've been discussing today is called The Roman Triumph, and Mary will appear tonight at 7 at the Dallas Museum of Art to give a lecture entitled The Other Side of Conquest, Prisoners and Victims in the Roman Triumph. Mary, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.